Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
A dream is a wish your heart makes when you're fast asleep.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The glass slipper, the fairy godmother, the evil stepmother, Prince Charming. The story of Cinderella is known to everyone. Disney has a new blockbuster movie just out with a live-action remake of its 1950 animated fairy tale classic. But it is just one version of a story that spans many cultures and hundreds of years. This hour on Point, love it, hate it, or in between, we're looking at the deep history and incredible staying power of the Cinderella story. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why Cinderella again? Do you connect with this story? Do you wish it would go away? Why the staying power? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We have maybe the best two fairy tale experts anywhere with us today. From St. Paul, Minnesota, Jack Zipes joins us, retired professor of German at the University of Minnesota, has written many, many books about fairy tales and their evolution, including The Irresistible Fairy Tale and Why Fairy Tales Stick. Jack Zipes, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Maria Tatar, chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard University, where she teaches German folklore, children's literature. Her brand new book is The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. Maria Tatar, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here.
All right. We were just bathed in a dream is a wish that your heart makes from the brand new movie. Huge box office, $132.5 million over the weekend. Kind of incredible to me, including a record-breaking $25 million in China, where I don't even know how they look at the Cinderella story, but they do look at it from this film we see. Maria, have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes.
And is...
My verdict?
Yes?
Well, let's start with the upside, which is... The minute you walk out of the theater, you have to start talking about this rags-to-riches story about – it's a tale about marrying up and about sexual rivalry between mothers and daughters. And so there were many moments in the film where I gasped.
Gasped? Why? Gasped.
Well, when I saw, for example, the crazy corset that is worn by Cinderella, she has a preternaturally – thin waist.
Playing Cinderella, and everybody's talking about just how tight that
corset
must be, or whether it's been CGI manipulated.
And then, you know,
she had to look like a Barbie doll. Yes.
She does, yeah, with the brains of a Barbie doll as well. But, so there were many moments there, but also it's a story that is wired, like all fairy tales, it's wired for weirdness. And you have these great scenes of transformations when the lizard hasn't quite made it back to human form and his tongue goes out and he catches a fly. So, but what I like best, as I say, is that it gets us talking.
We have here Anthony Lane in The New Yorker, Jack, saying Kenneth Branagh, who of course has directed many Shakespeare plays into movie form, Branagh has delivered in this Cinderella a construction project so solid, so naive, and so rigorously stripped of irony that it borders on the heroic. I love that. Jack, I mean, this is after years when it had to be super ironic or kind of deconstructionist if you wanted to approach a fairy tale this old.
Well, I almost fell asleep watching the film, and in fact, the young people around me were totally bored. It lacks humor. Inventiveness. It apes the original animated film of 1950, which had a lot of humor in it. This film lacks humor, and it basically is made to feed light entertainment to children and to adults. And repeatedly, they kept uttering this slogan, if you're kind and courageous, everything good will happen to you. I guess there may have been about 15 times that this line was repeated. And the fact is, in our world today, if you're kind and courageous, it's not going to get you too much.
Boy, Jack, you are going with the irony or cynicism that Kenneth is rejecting. I have to say, I talked with any number of families who saw it over the weekend and parents who adored that message. It's a tough world out there, and they're happy for their kids to hear it, Maria.
Oh, and that message is directed at parents and not at children. Children will run away from that message. In fact, cruelness starts to become really attractive when you see Cate Blanchett.
Cruelty, yes. I haven't seen it, but everybody says she's pretty amazing as the wicked stepmother.
She is. She's charismatic and attractive. She sort of drives the film in many ways. And I agree completely with Jack that, you know, that mantra-like repetition, the drumbeat. It is a barrage of just kindness and courage. And in fact, if you go back to fairy tales, you see what are the values enshrined in them. Courage, to be sure, but also cleverness, cunning. You should have your wits about you in this world. And in fact, you're usually better off when you lie, cheat, and steal your way to success.
We're going to go back and look at the origins of Cinderella. Here's just a little bit from the new Disney version. New one. Cinderella, played by Lily James, taunted here by her stepsisters, Anastasia and Drizella, played by Holiday Grainger and Sophie McShera, and her stepmother, of course, played by Cate Blanchett.
You'll get cinders in our tea.
I've got a new name for her. Cinder
Wench. Oh, Bertie looks so dirty.
Oh, dirty Ella. Cinderella. That's what we'll call you.
Oh, girls, you're too clever. Who's this for? Is there someone we've forgotten?
It's my place.
Oh, it seems too much to expect you to prepare breakfast, serve it, and still sit with us. Wouldn't you prefer to eat when all the work is done, Ella? Or should I say Cinderella?
And there you have it. Ella becomes Cinderella. And the landed gentry, her mother has died, her father has died. It's her house, but they've moved in. They're the bosses. Maria, I know that there are forms of this story, stories within this form all over the world, but this one, the Disney telling, goes back, I'm reading here, to 1697 in France. What's the origin?
Oh, yeah. Well, you could actually take the Fairy Tale Express to China, and you'll find that there's a recorded version from the 8th century. There's a Greek version that goes back to the first century BC. The one that we have enshrined, that we've made a cult of,
with pumpkins and mice and a fairy godmother.
Perrault. That is the Frenchman Charles Perrault, who created a book of fairy tales called Tales of Mother Goose. And he wrote the tales down in 1697, published them. And since then, we have had that has been our Cinderella. And, of course, as Jack points out, you know, this is the 1950 animated film turned into live action and not changed much at all.
Disney went back to Perrault to 1697. He did not go to the Brothers Grimm for this one, even though they told the story. Why not the Grimm brothers, Jack?
Well, I think the Grimm's tale is a little more gory, and Cinderella is much more active in terms of almost taunting or teasing the prince and leaving traces so that he can actually find her. And, of course, the ending in the Grimm Cinderella is something that families might object to. In the ending of the tale in the Grimm's version, the stepmother forces her two daughters to cut off their toes and their heels to try to fit their feet into the slipper, and the prince finds out when the blood ekes out of the slipper that she's not these two are not the right ones. And then later, when Cinderella travels in a carriage to her wedding, the two stepsisters are sitting in a carriage behind, and doves come down and peck out their eyes. Now, that's something I think that the Disney Corporation, in its prudish manner, would not want to show on the screen.
Cinderella more or less saved the Disney studio in 1950 and got us on this princess train that has never stopped since. Maria looks at Cinderella and sees a tale of marrying up and sexual rivalry between daughters and mothers and sisters. What do you see in this tale, Jack?
Yeah, I agree with Maria. In fact, it's the reason why this particular tale sticks and is so relevant in all its variants, thousands actually of different Cinderellas, is because we have a situation in which a widow marries a widower and comes in with two daughters whom she favors. They're her biological daughters, and she's faced with the fact that the father has his biological daughter who will probably inherit the house. He's a merchant. Mm-hmm. And in a situation like that, most biologists and psychologists and people who study evolutionary psychology point out there's a tendency in human beings to favor your own biological children. And here, the stepmother will stop at nothing, and will kill in order to promote her own children.
We're into biology. I don't know if that's evolutionary biology. We're also into Cinderella with Jack Zipes, retired professor of German at the University of Minnesota, author of Why Fairy Tales Stick, and with Maria Tatar, chair of the Folklore and Mythology Program at Harvard, author of The Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales, her latest and many other. The 13th movie version I'm reading here, out with the latest from Disney. Here's Julie Andrews, Rodgers and Hammerstein, 1957 live television version, famous song. We're talking Cinderella. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
In my own little corner, in my own little chair, I can be whatever I want to be. On the wing of my fancy, I can fly anywhere.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about centuries of Cinderella. Disney is out with a new movie version, but this story's been around in many, many forms for a long, long time. Of course, 1950, Disney's famous animated version. Here are those mice singing about their friend, Cinderella.
Cinderella, Cinderella, night and day, it's Cinderella. Make the fire, fix the breakfast, wash the dishes, do the mopping, and the sweeping, and the dusting. They always keep her hopping. She'd go around in circles till she's very, very dizzy. Still they holler, keep her busy, Cinderella. Yeah.
1950, but you can go much further back. We're talking about the meaning and staying power of this story. With Maria Tatar of Harvard, Jack Zipes joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota. You can join us as well. Why does this story still fascinate? Do you know how far back it goes? And what's the message in Cinderella? That a girl needs a prince? That stepmothers are mean? That it takes magic to go from rags to riches? Or in the latest movie version, that kindness and courage win in the end? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And here's Helena Bonham Carter playing the fairy godmother, Lily James's Cinderella, in the brand new version.
Ella, I almost forgot. Remember, the magic will only last so long. With the last echo of the last bell, at the last stroke of midnight, the spell will be broken, and all will return to what it was before.
Midnight.
Midnight.
That's more than enough time.
That's more than enough time for this beauty. Maybe there is some cunning here after all, Maria, Jack, lots of callers. Lorelai is calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Lorelai, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I couldn't wait to see the movie, and I'm glad that I have a 10-year-old daughter that I could drag with me. I felt compelled when we were going to see the movie to tell her that she didn't need a prince to make it in life. And and she could build her own castle. And she said, Mom, I know I can build my own castle, but let's just enjoy it for what it is.
And, so you're ready to school her with a feminist perspective, and she just wants to enjoy the film.
Right. And she walked away with the sense that the world could use a little bit more courage and a little bit more kindness. And I think that that's what we all should take away from it.
I love it. Jack, you hear that? There's a mother, Lorelai, who's happy for that message. But Maria, a little girl who, not so little, 10, but who maybe these days doesn't think, she already knows she doesn't need a prince, but it's still fun to think about it? I don't know. Feminists have not had a happy history with Cinderella.
I kind of like the fact that the film didn't go into the mode of you go, girl. And as much as, you know, I may not like that particular Cinderella, she does inspire me to get out there and talk. And there's a mother and daughter talking about a story, what it means to them, what's important. And I have a feeling that that conversation went on for a while with different versions, and maybe even talk about, is there such a thing as a male Cinderfella?
Or Cinderlad.
Cinderlad.
Jerry Lewis.
Absolutely. Yeah, a whole film in which, you know, he's persecuted by the wicked stepmother and his brothers. So right. And we could also look at the Irish Cinderlad. In The Turnip Princess, there are a couple of Cinderfellas. There's a Turkish Cinderlad as well.
Jerry Lewis is not on the air with us today. Jack, yeah. Take us back to the even deeper than 1697 and the Perrault version of Cinderella, to the kind of form of this that, as Maria and you say, we can find all over the world. And what is the elemental form of the Cinderella story without the pumpkins necessarily or the mice or the fairy godmother, the elemental structure?
Yeah, I think it's... a family drama, family melodrama or trauma, you could say, because when a mother dies, the daughter and father or husband will certainly be traumatized to a certain extent, particularly if the mother is a young mother. And we know in the medieval period and Renaissance period, many, many women died in childbirth. And so it was common that a new mother would be brought in at one point. And that, of course, would create problems of some kind, particularly if the mother tended to be young. So I think that the major problem has to do with a certain dysfunction in a family when a traumatic event occurs.
And Maria, give us some of the ways in which that story or some version has been packaged in different cultures over time, maybe earlier than Perrault.
Well, I would agree with Jack that it's about the hyper dysfunctional family. So you find in China there's a girl who's persecuted by her mother and stepsisters. What does she get but a dress and these beautiful shoes. So it's about dysfunctionality. I think one thing we haven't touched on is the innocent persecuted heroine. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, as children, we always feel, there's always a point when we feel that we're completely disempowered. The world is run by these ogres, by these adults, by these giants, and we never get our way. And we always have to work, do these chores or tasks or whatever. So this is a heroine and a hero, a Cinderella, that we can all identify with. We're, you know, sitting in that corner at the hearth, and nobody's paying any attention to us.
What about the rags to riches business, the class interaction here? I mean, there's something going on here where the prince, we wouldn't normally look at this girl, a kitchen wench or whatever you want, but once she's put in a gown.
And it is about wardrobe. In some ways, the Disney film, I think, is not a fairy tale, but a fairy tailor. Those gorgeous costumes worn by the stepsisters, not just by Cinderella. But there she is. She's a visual delight. And if you look at the trailer, you see nothing but Cinderella swirling around in that blue dress. And that's what I found disheartening. That is, that it is all about clothes and looks, and she becomes the flashpoint of the film in that dress.
What about economic status? I mean, that would have some...
Yeah, Jack.
Yeah, well, we tend to forget that she's not really from the poor family. She's from the upper middle class. Her father, in almost all the tales, the father tends to be a merchant of some kind and fairly well off. So it's that there's a myth that's built around this tale as though she, because of the fact that she's made to become a servant, it appears as though she's from a servant class, but that's not the case at all.
Of course. And, I mean, she's put into that role. That makes it very people who live in that role and aren't gentry may well identify with her because of that. 1950 in the animated version from Disney, here's a sound where the wicked stepmother, this is voiced by Eleanor Audley, sort of lays it down. Work, work, you Cinderella.
There's the large carpet in the main hall.
Clean it.
And the windows upstairs and down.
Watch them.
Oh, yes, and the tapestries and the draperies.
But I just finished...
Do them again! And don't forget the garden. Then scrub the terrace, sweep the halls and the stairs, clean the chimneys. And, of course, there's the mending and the sewing and the laundry.
Maria, I mean, I don't know, but it sounds... It's certainly presented that she needs a prince to get out of this. That's the way it's presented.
She sure does. And I think of the great contrast to the Snow White scene. Remember the housekeeping scene where everything is effortless
and the brooms.
And fun.
Yes.
And here again, you know, she's this victim. She may not be from the lowest social stratum, mm-hmm. but the fact is she's dirty. She has to do all kinds of terrible chores. So her rise is really dramatic. That is, she is the ugly duckling. I mean, you could think of that particular story as well. And all those makeover shows we have on reality TV. There's Susan Boyle,
Bachelor,
who sings
and all
for
the rest.
Us. Yeah. That transformation, that powerful transformation from the lowest to the very highest, whether it's social status or looks or whatever. That trajectory is very powerful, and we want to watch. We want to see that change is possible.
Even if it takes a little
magic.
Laura in Milwaukee. Laura, thank you for calling from Milwaukee. You're on the air, Laura.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I believe that that Disney sadly has co-opted these tales for commercial purposes, and that a strictly feminist and materialistic reading of the tales misses the deeper spiritual truths that are truly inherent in the tales. Instead of a prince and a princess coming together as we would see in the physical world, I believe it's truly a picture of the masculine and feminine sides being reunited in each one of us, and that this does cause a transformation and a certain completion, which is our divine origin and our ultimate future.
What do you mean by the masculine and feminine being reunited? Walk into the great hall and dance at the ball, and that's it? Yin-yang, one?
Well, the unity that we've come from in the spiritual world before we descended into our physical, material world, the unity before we came in a feminine body or a masculine mm-hmm. body was a wholeness, and that these tales tell of a reuniting of these two sides of ourselves.
Laura, let us pick it up right there. Maria, are you ready to go to the ecstatic mysticism here of reunification?
Well, I'm actually more interested in the idea of Disney appropriating the stories and creating a kind of global version of the tale. You know, in some ways, Disney was our portal to fairy tales in the 20th century. Disney kept the stories alive. Now, the downside to that was commercialization. And also, of course, merchandising. That's something we haven't touched on.
We will. Peggy Ornstein joins us in a few minutes.
She's the expert on that, you know. And I have no doubt that there will be many blue dresses for sale in Disney shops. So, you know, the real question is, what about all the fairy tales in our heads? The great thing to me is that we actually resist the fairy tales that we see on screen. We resist them by talking about them, by saying, what if this happened or that happened? These are counterfactuals, and they create conversations about possibilities. So the Disney film is out there, but it doesn't mean that we have to embrace it and say, oh, everything in there is just, that's how it should be.
I guess that's what makes a folk tale or fairy tale last, if it gets at something so deep and fundamental that we want to keep talking about
we
it.
We want to, and,
even if
and
we don't
create,
go for this version
and
or
make
that.
It, make it our own. Make it culturally relevant.
I want to ask about this connection of Cinderella in different tellings across time and nature. It comes up again in the new movie version. Lily James as Cinderella meets the prince by Richard Madden in the new movie. In the woods, this is well before the ball, and Cinderella saves a stag from the prince's hunting expedition. Of course, she doesn't know he's a prince.
Are you all right?
I'm all right, but you've nearly frightened the life out of him.
Who?
The stag. What's he ever done to you that you should chase him about?
I must confess I've never met him before. He is a friend of yours.
An acquaintance. We met just now. I looked into his eyes and he looked into mine, and I just felt he had a great deal left to do with his life. That's all.
Stag or mice, she looks into their eyes and there's a connection. Zach, Jack, this is not the only version in which Cinderella has this nature tie.
No, not at all. And, of course, getting back to the commercialization of folk and fairy tales by Disney, of course, the Disney studios will toss in like an animal rights motif for a touch of feminist just to sell better, you know, to the general public. But there is that scene reminded me in part of the great Czech film, which is called Three Wishes for Cinderella, came out in 1973, directed by Václav Voliček, in which a young woman who can shoot better than the prince and who is disguised as a young boy in the forest comes out and shoots much better than the prince and astonishes him. There's no animal rights sort of motif there, although she does have a horse to whom she talks, and she's quite often identified with nature. But it is key. I think it's a very important theme that one should look at in the different versions, the different variants of Cinderella. And I think there is a certain copying of I don't know whether Branagh knew about this Czech film, although it's a cult film even today in Europe.
When all the world turns against her in her immediate environment, she turns to nature and finds a response there. Roseanne in Miami, Florida. Roseanne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to first comment on how much I dislike the Disneyization of fairy tales, and I think The Little Mermaid is probably the one that angers me the most because it totally is not the original story.
But people sure do love it, Roseanne. They're out in incredible numbers this weekend.
When I tell people what that story really is, they're horrified. But anyway, what I really wanted to share with you is I am the PR director for the Jewish Cultural Arts Theater in Miami, and our youth division, we just started rehearsals for Around the World with Cinderella, based on the book by Lowell Schwartzell and Lillian Freeman. And we are doing the Chinese, Russian, Native American, and there's no Jewish, but my director has written a Jewish one. And the thing that I have found so interesting about these is that every one has a little bit of a different twist to it. Like the Chinese one, yes, there's wardrobe involved, but really, she redeems herself through her wits. And the Native American one, the girl is specifically not beautiful and redeems herself through her inner nature. So I think it's very interesting how different cultures look at this story. And I think it's a fascinating thing for the kids that are involved in this production to have the opportunity to look at that.
Roseanne,
really
good luck with it. You're all tapped into the many versions around the world, and it doesn't have to be necessarily glamorous in the Chinese version, Maria?
Oh, not at all. And it seems to me that there really is no authoritative version. You talked about The Little Mermaid, and you can go back to Andersen. And, you know, indeed, that was a literary story, but we can turn that into anything we want. And I'm totally tolerant about different versions. I think, you know, the more the merrier, and look at them and critique them and make your own, create your own. I love the idea of this play that you're doing different versions.
Yeah, 17 different ways. Maria Tatar, please stand by with me in the studio. Jack Zipes in St. Paul, Minnesota. When we come back, Peggy Ornstein joins us, author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, behind us here from the 1997 ABC television movie Cinderella with Whitney Houston and Brandy Impossible. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
Minchicaboola, bibbidi bobbidi boo. Put them together, and what have you got? Bibbidi bobbidi boo.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Cinderella is back, so is Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Helena Bonham Carter there is the fairy godmother in the brand new version, Disney version, of Cinderella. Huge box office this weekend in the United States and well beyond. Maybe that's appropriate. Cinderella, as a folktale, as a fairy tale, has roots and deep history all over the world. We're talking about it this hour with Maria Tatar of Harvard, Jack Zipes, along at the University of Minnesota, both big fairy tale experts. Maria's brand new book, The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales, and Jack with The Irresistible Fairy Tale out in 2012. You can join us this hour. Were you at the movies this weekend, at this movie? Did they capture the heart of this story? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lots of listeners writing online. Suzanne writes to us, "My 8.5-year-old daughter loved it. The beautiful ball gown didn't hurt. But I wonder," she writes, "if children can also identify with not being able to challenge adults in their lives, parents, coaches, teachers, even if those adults are not abusive." She goes on to say, "Having courage and being kind is not a bad thing, Jack. In this world, courage can take many forms. And the fact that the stepsisters are attractive on the outside but ugly on the inside is a plus as well." Maria, what about this? A lesson for kids. You can challenge adults even if they're not abusive adults. Appealing?
Well, certainly. This kindness theme, it seems to me that this Cinderella, the Disney Cinderella in the live action, is a completely passive figure. That is, kindness is this passive virtue. It, you know, again, by contrast.
Just in other words, sort of.
Just being and smiling and being sweet. And I want a Cinderella who has really a streak of rebelliousness in her, as she does in many of the earlier versions of the story. So, you know, again, in if you look at a whole range of fairy tales from all over the world, you find that she does have her wits about her, and she has to run here and there and escape from the prince and hide in a dovecote. And so she's no dumb bunny, really, as Anne Sexton said of Snow White.
Of course, Kenneth Branagh is on to something here. That, I mean, he's had a tremendous critical reception from critics who can be pretty tough. I'm looking here, Katie Waldman, Slate. Disney's Cinderella is thrillingly sincere, going for that. Go to Peggy Ornstein in just a second here. AJ in Berea, Kentucky. AJ, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you so much for this topic. I would like to ask all the aspiring Cinderellas out there and all the ones who don't want to be and all the ones who are rebelling against it, do you have any idea what it has been like to be a man trapped by the prince archetype.
What do you mean?
It sucks.
You mean all the women you know are looking for a prince and that ain't you?
Well, no, I mean that prince archetype, both men and women are trapped by these unrealistic, arcane, and dysfunctional archetypes. It's no more functional, it's no more healthy to be that prince who is always having to save people, who is always having to be handsome, who is always having to be of higher status. You know, the men suffer the exact same problem that the women are suffering from.
AJ, let us dive into the whole princess conundrum here. Thank you for that call. Peggy Ornstein joins us from San Francisco, journalist and author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter. She's thought a little bit about the princess side of that. Peggy, what do you say to AJ? He feels trapped in the prince archetype from the male side.
It's cheaper.
the outfits.
To be a princess these days.
I guess so. Is Cinderella still eating daughters, Peggy?
Well, my daughter is 11 and a half right now, and I think she would. Her assessment of the movie was it wasn't as bad as she thought it was going to be. So I think she's grown up a little bit.
You've really resisted the whole sort of princess obsession here. What's your gripe?
Well, gripe is a little. I want to say Maria and Jack. I worship both of them, and I love fairy tales. To me, when I look at the Disney phenomenon, it's less about the story and about the films than about the merchandising and the reduction of the fairy tale to being about appearance and consumerism for girls, and that's how they define femininity. So when you look at this new Cinderella, you know, Disney has to keep that juggernaut going. It's a $5 billion a year industry, the princess industry, and they have to keep thinking of new products and new markets, and the princess market had kind of condensed to being 3 to 5 year olds. So now what they're trying to do is make it a womb to tomb thing. So, you know, I imagine any second now they're going to come out with a Snow White coffin. That's going to be the next thing.
Oh, all glass. Oh, no.
Yeah.
What? I love what you're saying.
Why does it sell, Peggy? It's appealing to something here.
I think it appeals to a number of things. It appeals to a nostalgia on the part of parents for kids. I mean, I looked at it more as a children's phenomenon, and I really did when I first started looking at this was when my daughter was 3, and she's 11 now, so I've been I didn't expect this to be an 8-year gig, to be honest, and I was looking at, you know, what had happened, what was this Disney princess phenomenon, because that as a concept didn't exist when we were kids. That's a new thing. The idea that these characters are marketed separately from their movies didn't start until 2000, and that is what the $5 billion industry is about. And so when they're looking at the marketing of this, people used to say, well, it's a phase, girls grow out of it. And I'd say, well, of course, I'm not an idiot. I know that. But now we're really not supposed to grow out of it. So now when you look at the marketing of this Cinderella, which they really are specifically trying to attract in the merchandising, mid-30s to mid-50s, that's what they're looking at. So they have a $600 I Have Arrived Cinderella Collection Crystal Necklace, or the $75 pair of Cinderella and Prince Charming champagne flutes, or the $4,595 pair of Jimmy Choo glass slippers that you can get now.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Peggy. Surely you're not trying to tell us that not until the year 2000 were people bedazzled by royalty. I mean, that has been around a long time.
No. There was a change that happened in the merchandising. So what used to happen with Disney was, I mean, kids have been playing, you know, princes and queens and knights and all that since the beginning of time, but they used their own scripts for the most part, or they had, you know, scripts from sort of books. But what happened was in the year 2000, a new head of Disney Consumer Products Licensing came in, and he saw an ice show where girls were coming to the ice show dressed in their own princess costumes that they made themselves out of their own stuff. That is anathema to Disney, that somebody should use their own creativity. So he went back and he suggested taking these characters. It used to be that Cinderella would come out, the movie would come out before VCRs and all that kind of stuff. It would be in the theaters, you could get some princess merchandise, Cinderella merchandise, and then it would go back in the vault. And you wouldn't have anything related to Cinderella on the shelves or in the movie theaters or anything for 7 years. So it was gone. So what he did was he took the characters out of their movies and placed them together under this idea of Disney princesses and put the merchandise out there 24/7, 365 days a year. That was the new thing. And it was really resisted by kind of old school people within the Disney company, including Roy Disney, who was Walt's nephew. And so to appease that segment, what they did was, if you look at any Disney princess product that has more than one princess on it, even the Frozen ones, you'll notice that they are not, they never, they're all looking slightly different directions, because they're not supposed to know that the other...
They're in different universes.
Are there.
Parallel universes.
Self-contained.
Yeah. Yeah, they're supposed to be in their own universes. They're not supposed to know that the other ones are there. So that way, the trouble was they didn't want to mix universes because, right. I don't know, the world would implode or something
Peggy,
like that.
Peggy, you're sure. Fighting the tide. You're fighting the tide, I think. I mean, I hear... the reservations here, but I've also heard so many. My beloved sister-in-law off to the movie with young Avery over the weekend, and it's loved it. Little Avery loved it. Hope and Courage. Who can argue with Hope and Courage? Sue in Windsor, Vermont. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think?
I didn't see the Cinderella movie yet. I am very anxious to see it. As a matter of fact, I might go today. First and foremost, I've been listening for about a half an hour, and I believe that kindness is not a passive virtue. It is reciprocal. If anyone is kind to another person, it is more likely that the person will be kind in return. My two nieces and my one nephew in Massachusetts saw the movie yesterday. And loved it. The two nieces that I have, Annabelle and Rose, are 8 years old and six. They liked the movie a lot. My nephew, who's Henry, who's four, enjoyed it also. He identified somewhat with Prince Charming. And Tom, yeah. One caller, AJ, mentioned about the fantasy that men should be tall, handsome, and good-looking. And I disagree. I'm 65, and I believe beauty is in the eye of the beholder. If a person loves someone, they see beauty in the person, not whether their hair and eyes and nose and features are handsome.
Sue, I'm right there with you. And AJ and Maria, take heart. Sue is out there. Maria, what about all those kids in her realm who just loved it?
Well, I would say one of the great things about this movie is that it did expand the audience. And Peggy, I'm a huge fan of your book, but here's where I think we disagree. I like the idea of bringing back fairy tales, not just for the young, but for every generation. And one of the remarkable things about the Disney film is that evidently 30% of the viewers were men. That is, this was not just a chick movie or a movie for kids, but, you know, young and old were there. And so I like that direction. And I also think that you can resist the commodification of the fairy tale. That is, fairy tales are just words. There's stories. There's stories that you can talk about, and there's nothing better than that. And I love the critique of the commodification, because I think we should all be aware of what is going on in the catalogs and in the stores and online and these crazy things that are being sold. But you could also say, no, I will focus on the story, what it means to me, and what I think it should be.
Peggy, are you arguing with the enduring power of these stories?
No, I actually completely agree with everything Maria just said. I mean, I, as I said at the beginning, I love fairy tales. I read fairy tales to my daughter all the time, always have. A great variety of them, largely, you know, enlarged partly by Maria's work. And the commodification, what I want to do is bring awareness there so that we think about, well, what does it mean that, you know, that Disney is doing this as part of a marketing juggernaut? And why do we define our fairy tales through the Disney lens in contemporary
but
culture?
But Perrault sold his book. The Grimm brothers sold their books. I mean, those were commercial enterprises, too.
Absolutely, but they weren't also selling a $5,000 glass slipper along with their book. There's nothing wrong with selling things, but yeah. You know. But this has consumed eight. What my concern with the little girls was that it had consumed their childhood, so that they were playing absolutely nothing else from the age of 3 to 5. They were walking around with the assumption that they were princesses. And I'd also say, you know, we don't have a whole lot of things selling that shows Cinderella in her kind, courageous rags state. We have Cinderella, the beautiful girl,
triumphant
at the ball.
Yeah. Eric in Oklahoma City. Eric, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have been listening to this, and it made me sort of think of a Scottish fairy tale I read where the main protagonist was supposed to be the prettiest girl around, but her mother was worried she couldn't marry off because she couldn't do any of the housework chores, etc. She was a lazy girl. So I was kind of wondering if when Cinderella was first told, if maybe part of the message wasn't towards guys, that just because somebody's pretty doesn't mean they're good, and so the hardworking, industrious Cinderella is the one that actually gets the prince, gets the guy in the end.
I love it, Eric. Jack, she's a fine-looking young woman, but she's also the one who's working. Is that the message here, Jack?
No, not at all. I don't think so.
There, come on. There are other, she's scrubbing the floor.
There are other tales like Rumpelstiltskin, the spinning tales, where a lazy spinning girl must learn to be industrious in order to win a prince or win a man. But I want to get back to this whole commodification in Disney. I think we should take it much more seriously. First of all, Disney has a monopoly on distribution in the United States, and quite often blocks in the past in the history, blocked other animated films or films from coming to America, or the way the American cinema is set up, only certain fairy tale films make their way into the theaters. And I think that the commodification has had an impact on the socialization, both of young boys and young girls. And I think that we have to try to do something about this in order to resist the type of commodification that exists, because it does not create generous, kind, and courageous people. It creates people who are going to consume without thinking. And I think that what we need are films that are enjoyable, but also to a certain extent challenge young people, young and old people, to use their wits so that they can see through what is happening in our society today. So we can't just simply dismiss the fact that this is a banal, boring film that has a nice message. We really should try to do something to change our culture so that we can create films that have deeper meanings and are more profound.
Peggy, we've just got a few seconds. It is durable, this story. Right now it's omnipresent. How to get the best out of it if you're off to the theater with a son or daughter?
I would say to try to expand your repertoire. Look around and see what else is out there besides Cinderella that you can use as a way to expand the conversation.
And how about Frozen?
Always an alternative. Well, in their millions, people around the world headed off to this film, film of a very, very old story. We've learned a lot in this hour. Maria Tatar of Harvard, thank you very much for joining us today. Jack Zipes, joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
And Peggy Ornstein, author of Cinderella, Ate My Daughter. Thank you for joining us, Peggy, in San Francisco.
Thanks, Tom.
Here, Do I Love You Because You're Beautiful, from the Broadway cast Cinderella 2013. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.